Good evening. My name is Jeanette Sanger. I'm a trustee of this wonderful library, and it's so great to welcome all of you tonight for what I know will be a wonderful talk. And it's so wonderful to have the chance to introduce Francine, who I've known as a wonderful writer in my bookstore, Books and Company, and also a very lovely customer. So it's wonderful to reconnect with her tonight. Before we started, I wanted to let you know that this is the time of year we ask for money for our annual fund here at the library, as our dues don't cover all of our operating costs, and so the extra money that comes in helps to pay for wonderful evenings like this. And Francine's own biography seems as exciting and exotic as Axel Fersen's, Marie Antoinette's Swedish lover. She was born in Poland to a French diplomat and a Russian emigre mother. She escaped with her widowed mother to France in 1940, and in 1942, her mother married Alexander Liberman, another white emigre from Russia, and he became a longtime director at Vogue. So Francine Duplessis-Gray grew up in an extraordinary milieu of artists and writers and intellectuals. She grew up in New York City and has had a long and distinguished career here. She was a reporter for several French magazines, book editor for Art in America, staff writer for The New Yorker, and has had several professorships, including Columbia University. She has written two novels, as well as histories, biographies, and an astute family memoir, Them, A Memory of My Parents. Her latest and highly acclaimed book, a historical novel, The Queen's Lover, takes place partially during the tragic reign of Marie Antoinette, one of my favorite periods in history to read about. And I love this romantic story of Marie Antoinette and Axel Fersen, which brings to vivid life Versailles and its gilded grandeur and also the toxic filth and the French court to vivid life. The portrait of the Swedish court and Axel Fersen's final days are equally fascinating. It is interesting to note that when Marie Antoinette was guillotined, our own society library was already 40 years old. And now let us welcome Francine Duplessis-Gray.
Thank you, dear Jeanette. Maria Antonia Josepha Johanna of Austria-Lorraine, known to us as Marie Antoinette, was the kind of tomboyish girl who would make most mothers despair, the kind who refused to concentrate on her studies and preferred romping through woods with her friends. Her own brother, Emperor Joseph II of Austria, called her Featherhead. She was indeed phenomenally uneducated. Her ignorance was in part caused by the fact that she was extremely myopic and preferred to be read to in order to acquire the little book knowledge she had. The 15th and favorite child of Empress Maria Theresa of Austria, who ruled her country in consort with her oldest son, Emperor Joseph II, Marie Antoinette had been brought up at a court known for dowdy, Spartan simplicity, a warm, familial court where etiquette was minimal, where intrigues were ill-considered. Compare Schönbrunn, the Habsburg estate near Vienna, to its French counterpart, Versailles. When she arranged Marie Antoinette's marriage to Dauphin Louis Auguste, the future Louis XVI, one wonders whether Maria Theresa knew how risky it was to launch her naive, guileless daughter into Europe's most scheming, most wily aristocracy. Marie Antoinette was the most alluring and most troublesome of Maria Theresa's children. Tall and very slender, with a cascade of wavy, dark blonde hair, she could not have been called beautiful in any classical sense because of that darn Habsburg mouth, the slightly pendulous lip that marred the looks of most of her relatives. But her eyes, her skin, were a cause of wonderment for all. Here's how her eventual lover, the Swedish nobleman Axel von Fersen, would describe her eyes. Fringed by sumptuously thick lashes, one was conquered by their singular dark blueness, akin to the deep blue sky the sky takes on, akin to that deep blue the sky takes on in the pre-dusk hours of a brilliant day. The attribute for which Marie Antoinette may have been most noted, her carriage and her walk, are again described by her friend Fersen. "Walking is an inadequate word for her style of motion," he wrote. "When she moved through a room, she glided or floated rather than strode, reminding one of those music box figurines that waltz about a skating ring, sliding serenely across the make-believe ice." Suffice it to say that Marie Antoinette's grandfather-in-law, Louis XV, who appreciated female charms as few rulers of his time and was particularly enchanted with her, described her as, I quote, "a dainty little morsel." One should also note that Madame de Staël, who seldom praised other women's charms, was particularly taken by the French queen's extreme civility and gentleness of manner, which she extended to the most humble of her attendants. "Her manner," Staël wrote, "had a kind of affability which did not allow us to forget that she was a queen, yet persuaded us that she had forgotten all about it." But I also referred to Marie Antoinette as Maria Theresa's most troublesome child. This had little to do with the fact that she soon gained a reputation for frivolity and spendthriftness, particularly in regard to clothes. No, it had to do with the nature of a marriage to Louis XVI, a marriage which became a cause célèbre throughout Europe because it was not consummated for an entire 7 years. A brief aside is needed on the persona of Louis XVI. I'm deliberately revisionist here. He was not at all the dolt popular opinion has held him to be. He was indeed timid, awkward, gauche, incapable of the swift, idle banter that was a mode of conversation at his court. It is well known that he loved physical occupations such as blacksmithing, that he tended to eat gluttonously, that he would often labor alongside workers repairing a roof in Versailles, that he felt far more at ease with his humblest objects than with any aristocrats at his court. What is less well known is that he was above all a true scholar. Louis XVI was one of the most gifted Latinists of his time, one of the best read men of his day. He was fluent in English. He knew reams of Milton by heart and had even translated many of that poet's verses into French. However, these excellent qualities were overshadowed by a severe physical disability, the very disability that initially kept him from consummating his marriage to Marie Antoinette. Let's be blunt about Louis's problems. He had no trouble getting an erection, but experienced terrible pain as soon as he'd begun to have intercourse. After a few minutes, he apologized, bade his bride goodnight, and retired to his own bedroom. This went on for 7 whole years. The lack of significant stains on the princely sheets became an issue of lively gossip throughout Europe. Within 2 years of the Dauphine's marriage, fishwives began shouting at the poor girl, "Are you a woman or not? Give us an heir." Already very melancholy by nature, easily given to depressions, Marie Antoinette was further dejected by this rather important detail of a marriage. After 7 years of this nonsense, by this time she was queen, her older brother, Emperor Joseph II of Austria, decided to remedy a nuptial predicament which was threatening the very balance of power in Europe. Joseph was a blunt fellow, good at man-to-man talk. He appeared at Versailles and asked Louis some brutally forthright questions. He then wrote the following report to his brother Leopold in Vienna. I quote, "The king has normal erections. He introduces his member, stays there without moving for about 2 minutes, then withdraws without ejaculating, and still erect, bids good night. This is incomprehensible because he sometimes has nocturnal emissions, but while inside and never, and during the process, never. Oh, if I could only be present sometime, I would take care of him. He should be whipped so hard, he would discharge like a donkey." Together, they are total fumblers. And Joseph II saved the day, having summoned a doctor to Versailles and heard his diagnosis. Joseph convinced his brother-in-law that he suffered from a readily curable condition called phimosis. Louis experienced serious pain whenever he attempted to have sex because his foreskin was abnormally tight, but this could be remedied by a brief operation. So after some weeks of demurring, Louis agreed, was given a big shot of brandy, and within some 20 minutes of surgery, voila, he came out of it with an absolutely normal penis. The young couple set to work again. Within a few months, the Dauphine reported to her mother that her period, which the two women referred to by the euphemism General Krutendorf, was 2 or 3 weeks late, and shortly thereafter, the doctor came and confirmed it all. The kind young king exulted. The royal couple would go on to have 4 children, to whom they were extravagantly devoted. Marie-Thérèse, who would live on into the mid-19th century, the first Dauphin, who would die at the age of 10, just before the revolution of 1789, the second Dauphin, known after his father's death as Louis XVII, who died of neglect in a jail cell in 1795, and Sophie, a girl who died when she was barely a year old. Yet, however chaste Marie Antoinette was, and I cannot emphasize enough that contrary to common opinion, she was as chaste as she was pious, those 7 initial years of humiliation were bound to make her all the more susceptible to the advances of a handsome man. It is at a mass ball at the Paris Opera in 1774 that she met the Swedish nobleman, Count Axel von Fersen, who was to be the love of her life. Both of them were then 19. Von Fersen came from Sweden's wealthiest and most politically eminent family. His father had been Grand Marshal of Sweden, the most powerful post any Swede could hold, short of being king. Axel himself was an intimate friend of King Gustavus III, the greatest Swedish king of the Enlightenment. Slender and very tall, 6'6", with a long, narrow face and large, dark eyes, he was renowned for his handsomeness and was known throughout Europe as Le Beau Fersen. Highly cultivated, he played the clarinet and the piano and was also a gifted watercolorist. And these predilections may have reinforced the bond he formed with Marie Antoinette, who herself was of a very artistic nature. Fersen was clearly a ladies' man, but however passionate he might be in his private life, his public persona was highly formal, even aloof, especially in the company of women. They swarmed about him so that he did everything he could to deter them. He was often referred to as having a heart of fire under a crust of ice. The Queen and Fersen met again at many functions after that first meeting at the Opera Ball, but a romantic liaison was made impossible by Fersen's hectic traveling schedule, for the King of Sweden kept sending him on various diplomatic missions abroad. However, Versailles courtiers were quick to notice that Marie Antoinette, who had become queen in 1775, paid very special attention to the handsome Swede. Tongues began to wag, and 1780, 2 years after France declared war on England and began to support America in our war of independence, was an ideal time for Fersen to leave for America. He joined the French expeditionary forces led by General de Rochambeau. Because of his excellent command of English, Fersen was appointed to be Rochambeau's chief aide-de-camp. Fersen wrote numerous letters to his father from America, which I quote in my book, and which are most interesting in their descriptions of the major battles of the war, Yorktown, Charleston, and particularly of George Washington's personality. Fersen, who was in the thick of several battles, received many decorations for his military valor. What about Marie Antoinette, who had been pining for her swain in Versailles? We know that they wrote each other while Fersen was in America, but this part of their correspondence, like much of their letters, alas, was eventually destroyed by an idiotically puritanical great-nephew of Fersen. However, we know from Fersen's journals, which he wrote in French being the lingua franca of the Swedish nobility, that he had rushed to see the queen at Versailles the very day he returned to Paris. They seem to have consummated their love shortly after Fersen's return from America, on July 15, 1783, to be exact, where Fersen would commemorate that day in his journals for the rest of his life. The question inevitably arises, how did Louis XVI deal with his wife's infidelity? Well, the king was both humble and realistic. However much he loved his queen, he was highly aware of his own shortcomings, and he might have been relieved that she was favoring a man of legendary discretion and tact, a foreigner who was often away in his own native land, a man, moreover, whom he knew to be utterly dedicated to the royalist cause at a time when it was beginning to be radically challenged. I don't need to tell you that political unrest grew apace in France throughout the 1780s. There were bread riots, the treasury was vastly depleted, although the only inhabitants of the Bastille on July 14, 1789, were a libertine aristocrat and three madmen, one of whom was certain that he was Julius Caesar. The symbolic event of that onslaught was enormous. The news reached Versailles in the late evening and was brought to the royal couple by the Duc de la Rochefoucauld. "So it's a revolt?" Louis XVI asked. "No, sire," the Duke replied. "It is a revolution." Fersen was not at Versailles on July 14th, but he was there 3 months later on October 5th, when thousands of Parisian working women, armed with sickles and guns, incited by the rising price of bread, organized a march on Versailles. "The king to Paris, the king to Paris," the mob shouted as it broke into the palace and headed for the king and queen's apartments, killing several of the queen's bodyguards on the way. For the mob's original intent of securing more food had soon been replaced by the determination to transfer the royal family permanently to Paris. The crowds grew quieter as the royal couple and their children began to depart. General Lafayette and his National Guard headed the cortege. Fersen traveled a few hundred feet in back of the royal family, trying to avert his gaze from the sight of the slain bodyguards' heads, which the mob was carrying on pikes, and hoping against hope that the queen not be exposed to that terrible vision. The king and queen had been advised that upon being transferred to Paris, they would not be living at the Louvre, home to several ancestors of Louis XVI, but at the Tuileries, a building originally erected in the 16th century for Catherine de Médicis. Intimacy for Fersen and the queen was far harder to come by at the Tuileries than it had been at Versailles. And later that year, Fersen fell prey to the charms of an aggressive beauty called Eleanor Sullivan, a voluptuous Italian-born brunette who in her youth had done a turn as a circus dancer and trapezist. She had another steady paramour, a wealthy Scotsman called Quentin Crawford. Both were royalists devoted to Louis XVI and his family, but Fersen's sister Sophie, his confidant and most beloved sibling, grew wary of the affair. "I'm warning you, dear Axel," she wrote, "for the love of her to whom this news would cause a fatal blow, spare her the worst pain of all." But Fersen did not heed to advice and would remain Eleanor Sullivan's lover on and off in an occasionally uneasy ménage à trois until the end of the decade. Fersen went back and forth to Sweden a few times in the following 2 years, but returned in 1791 when Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette, chafing at their captivity at the Tuileries, called him in to advise them about what course of action they should take. This is how Fersen came to devise an escape plan for the royal family, familiar to those of you who saw that fine film, The Night of Varennes, with Marcello Mastroianni and Hanna Schygulla. According to Fersen's plans, the royal couple and their immediate family would flee to Varennes, a town on the border of Austrian-controlled Belgium, where a variety of European troops that supported the French monarchy would help them to cross the Channel and settle in Great Britain. The escape plan failed for a variety of reasons. It failed because the king, disguised as a valet, insisted on traveling in the same coach with the entire family, a bourgeois decision which forced Fersen to order a flamboyant, disastrously noticeable carriage that needed 6 horses. It failed because the queen, who was disguised as a children's governess, insisted that the group include a hairdresser, Léonard, a hysterical wimp who played an important role in the Varennes debacle. But the principal cause of the fiasco was that the king, at the last minute, refused to have Fersen join a venture which clearly needed an able-bodied military man who might take control if trouble arose. It is reasonable to believe that Louis XVI did not want to be accompanied by his wife's lover. In the tragicomic last hours of this ill-fated venture, a grocer named Jean-Baptiste Source invites the royal family to rest at his home, where he sells candles, hams, and other provisions. A judge who had once visited Versailles walks into the room, recognizes the king, falls to his knees, and utters the fatal word, "Oh, sire!" "Eh bien," Louis says, "I am indeed your king," as he goes about the room, embracing all the citizens, butchers, bakers, candlestick makers, who have assembled there, and are all weeping at the simplicity, tenderness, and warmth of their monarch, weeping because they may well have had some insight into the fate that awaited him. It's indeed one of the great ironies of European history that the Capet dynasty, the royal descendants of Saint Louis, came to its end in a grocer's shop in a small village of the Marne. Within an hour of these events, the National Guard arrived, accompanied by 2 members of the National Assembly, to take the royal family back to Paris. And both Republican deputies, particularly one called Antoine Barnave, who would later write his memoirs, were soon conquered by the friendliness and warm simplicity of the royal passengers. Instead of the aloof, domineering Catherine de Médicis kind of woman Marie Antoinette's detractors alleged her to be, so Barnave would later write, he found a pale, shattered woman, a remarkable, gracious human being who was bearing a difficult plight with admirable dignity. Outside the coach, however, the crowds grew increasingly malevolent as the royals approached Paris. Many women howled for the queen's head and asked for her intestines to be distributed among them to wear on their hats. To appease them, Marie Antoinette tried to lift the dauphin to the window, but one woman shouted, "Take him away. We know that fat hog isn't his father." The royal coaches lumbered into Paris through the Champs-Élysées 3 hours after their departure. 3 days after their departure. As the royal family drove up to the Tuileries, they saw huge placards placed at its gates which read, "Maison à louer," house for rent. As for Marie Antoinette, when she had rested a bit, she sent for her principal chambermaid, Madame Campan. It was Madame Campan who stated in her marvelous memoirs that during the 3-day ordeal, Marie Antoinette's golden hair had turned snow white like that of a woman of 70. A few days after her return, the Queen wrote Fersen a hurried note, which he received in Brussels, a prominent refugee center for European realists, royalists. It is just about the only love letter exchanged between the two, which escaped the censoring blade of Fersen's grandnephew. "I can only tell you that I love you, Marie Antoinette," wrote Fersen. "Advise me as to whom I should send the few letters I'll be able to write you, for I can't live without writing you. Adieu, the most beloved and loving of men. I kiss you with all my heart." We are now in late June 1791. The king only has a year and a half to live, and he spends them in a mood of stoically calm despair, reading and rereading the history of Charles I of England, who had been decapitated on Cromwell's orders a century and a half earlier. In January 1792, Fersen arrives in Paris ostensibly to discuss a new escape plan for the royal couple devised by his king, Gustavus III. He reaches the queen's apartments shortly after 6 p.m. He remains there for 24 hours until 6 p.m. the following day, a fact disconcerting to those historians, and there have been quite a few of them, who have pleaded that Marie Antoinette's relationship with Fersen was merely close platonic friendship. At 6 p.m. on the second day, he finally goes to see Louis XVI, who refuses the Swedish king's new escape plan. Taking leave of the royal couple, he tells them that he's off to Spain and Portugal, but, and this is a caddish side to Fersen that we have to face up to, he goes, in fact, to spend a week with his mistress, Eleanor Sullivan. At Eleanor's, he hides in the servants' quarters, taking care to keep his shoes off at all times, because the study used by Quentin Crawford, Eleanor's lover, is directly beneath his room. When Crawford spends the evening at home, meals are sent up to Fersen secretly on a dumb waiter. But notwithstanding the amusing intrigues of his stay at the Crawfords, Fersen was too painfully concerned about Marie Antoinette. Plagued by his worries about the queen, on a day in late February, after a week, he sensed it was time for him to end the charade with Eleanor, and he returned to Brussels. That was January 1792. Let us skip to January 23rd, the morning of Louis XVI's execution. In the past months, he and his family had been transferred from the Tuileries to the Temple Tower. Louis XVI had been separated from his family a few weeks before his trial and confined to his own private apartment. This had been a fresh source of sorrow for the Queen, for in this gauche, ungainly man, whom she had once derided with her frivolous friends, she had recently discovered many precious qualities: his courage and fortitude, the calm and patience he maintained in the most dire of circumstances. And the most amazing thing had then happened to Marie Antoinette. She fell passionately in love with her husband. She sat by him round the clock whenever he fell ill and cooked for him and made his bed herself. The king, in turn, living in unprecedentedly close quarters with his wife, came to esteem her own brand of courage and treasure as he never had before her extraordinary devotion to her family. Their parting may have been all the more painful because each of them had begun to cherish qualities they had never perceived in each other during their 20 years of marriage. On the eve of his death, the king seemed to have finally experienced, after all these years, the sweet certainty of knowing he was loved. "Alas," he said to his confessor in his last hours, "must it be that I love so deeply and am so tenderly loved in return?" January 22nd, 1793, the night before his execution, Louis, this bizarrely stoic man, dined excellently that evening, enjoying an entire beef roast, a half chicken, and a bottle of champagne, and slept very soundly. At the appointed hour of the morning, Louis got into his coach in the company of the Franco-Irish priest who had been assigned to him as confessor. It took him to the Place de la Révolution, now Place de la Concorde, where all executions were being held. The steps to the scaffold were very steep. The king leant on his confessor. Having reached the last step, he let himself loose from his confessor and ran to the other side of the scaffold. "Frenchman," he shouted at the crowd, "I die innocent of all the crimes of which I have been charged. I pardon those who have brought about my death." Louis's next and last words were interrupted by the guillotine itself. May my blood strengthen the happiness of the foe. Son of Saint Louis, ascend to heaven, the priest cried out as a 12-inch blade came crashing down. The king's dripping head was held up to the crowd by the executioner. There were loud shouts of Vive la République! The effect of the king's execution on the French population at large was not at all what the revolutionary regime had hoped. Those who witnessed the event testified of the mournful air that hung over Paris. Most windows remained shuttered. Citizens stayed inside their houses. There were many suicides that day. A woman threw herself into the Seine. A wig maker cut his throat. A librarian went mad. The American envoy, Gouverneur Morris, wrote to Thomas Jefferson, "The late king of this country has been publicly executed. He died in a manner becoming his dignity. I have seen grief such as for the untimely death of a beloved parent." Upon hearing that the king was to be executed, Fersen had still feared that Marie Antoinette might be guillotined alongside him. "My dread is unimaginable," he wrote his sister, Sophie, before he received any official news of the king's demise. "Poor queen, why can't I save her with my blood? It would be the greatest happiness for me, the greatest joy." A few days later, in a missive bear made barely coherent by grief, "My tender, kind Sophie, oh, pity me. I've now lost everything in the world. Why didn't I die at her side and for her?" A few days later, in a missive, and for her. As for the Queen's execution, 9 months later, on October 16, 1793, many indignities were imposed on her that had not been inflicted upon her husband. Some weeks earlier, she had been separated from her children and sent into solitary confinement at the Conciergerie. On the appointed date at 11 a.m., when Marie Antoinette left her cell, the executioner held the end of the rope with which he had tied her hands, leading her like a farm animal. As she left the Conciergerie, the queen was terribly startled to see the manure cart in which she was to be taken to the scaffold. She had expected to be taken there in a closed carriage, as her husband had been. 30,000 troops were lined up along the route. For a moment, the cart stopped. A smiling child, held up by its mother, blew her a kiss. The queen's eyes filled up with tears, but there were also many yells of hatred. "Make way for the Austrian! Long live the Republic!" After a brief bout of tears, the queen remained impassive, expressionless. Furious about the dignity and courage she displayed throughout her last hours, the revolutionary journalist Jacques-René Hébert would write, "The slut was audacious and insolent to the end." The car turned into the Rue Saint-Honoré. How many times had she gone down that street on the way to the opera in her glittering finery and flashy Leonard headdress, sitting in a gold and silver carriage drawn by 8 white horses? "Death to the Austrian," vowed voices shouted. By the time the tumbril arrived, the Place de la Révolution was filled with a huge, noisy crowd. When she looked to the left, the queen could see the Tuileries, where she had lived happy days with the family, where Axel had held her in his arms, and whose garden she had played with the children. The cart stopped in front of the scaffold. Not accepting any help, Marie Antoinette hurriedly climbed the stairs with the same light, lilting step that had once so enchanted her peers. She climbed it so speedily, in fact, that she lost one of her shoes, and upon reaching the platform, she trod on the executioner's foot. "I beg your pardon, sir, I didn't do it on purpose. I beg your pardon, sir, I didn't do it on purpose." Those were her last words. It was 12:15. According to witnesses, she shut her eyes as she was tied upon the upright wooden plank. The plaque was then tipped horizontally, and the heavy wooden collar was fixed around her bare neck. Another half minute passed. One heard the guillotine's whistling whir and click. Then the executioner held up her head by its white hair, carrying it around the scaffold to great applause. Fersen received the news of her death in Brussels 4 days later. "My grief, rather than diminishing, grows worse day by day," he wrote a week after he had heard. "Her face follows me wherever I go. That she was alone in her last moments with no one to comfort her, that fills me with horror." Fersen himself died a very brutal death in 1810, 17 years after the love of his life. He had a few brief liaisons, but none that were significant, and he never married. It is said that after Marie Antoinette's death, he never smiled again. Thank you. Now comes a question period, which is always the favorite part of such an event. Yeah. Oh, I think the DNA has proved that he was Louis XVI's child. There were rumors at the time that he was Fersen's child, but that has been totally scientifically disproved. Yeah.
Since
Fersen's sister's name was Sophie and her daughter's name was Sophie, was there any connection? Any suggestion there? I think probably there was, and it was excusable from the point of view. From the point of view of the king, because he had had a sister called Sophie, so that it made sense that way. Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you researched this?
Well, much of their correspondence, but not all, is published, and much of his journals also are published. But I went to Stockholm a couple of times to research the part of their journal that were not published. And it was easy for me because he wrote them in French. The Swedish aristocracy exclusively spoke French to each other, wrote their journals in French, wrote all their correspondence to each other in French. King Gustav III is said to have spoken Swedish with a French accent. They only spoke Swedish to their domestics, to their servants. And so it was easy for me to read Fersen's journals, which were written in beautiful French, very legible, beautiful handwriting. And that's where I picked up a lot of the extra stuff which was not published. And also, it was important to see the places where he lived because his father, as I said, was the wealthiest man in Sweden, and they built beautiful castles. There's one called Stenninge in particular and Lofstad, and they're built in the 17th century in a certain kind of Swedish Baroque style, which is very, very beautiful and very unique and full of wonderful furniture, some of them. So that was important, too, to see the houses in which he spent weekends and his youth and where he retired after Marie Antoinette's death. Yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit more about the circumstances surrounding Fersen's death?
Yes. Crown Prince of Sweden had died of apoplexy, and there were two factions proposing new crown princes. And Fersen belonged to one particular faction, and he was killed by members of the opposing faction. What is interesting is that the space in which he was, the street corner, the place in which he was killed is architecturally untouched, and it remains the same two centuries later. And you can actually stand in the street in which he was killed. It's an amazing thing. It was in a kind of bar restaurant at the second floor, and a gang of followers of the Crown Prince he opposed caught him, dragged him into this little plaza in front of the city hall, and stampeded him to death. So it was, in its way, as horrible a death as Marie Antoinette's. It's as if they were both cursed. Yes. Any other movie?
Movies, yes.
A movie? Oh, yes. There's a 1937 movie, Marie Antoinette, with Norma Shearer playing the Queen and Tyrone Power playing Fersen, which is just stupendous. Absolutely marvelous. I recommend you all go to Netflix and get it. Have you seen it?
Yes.
Isn't it marvelous?
Costumes by
Pardon me? Costumed by Adrian, and then what is the name of the wonderful British actor who plays Louis XVI?
Robert Morley.
Robert Morley. It's a marvelous movie. It's one of the best movies of the 30s. Yeah. Oh, but I'd like to put in, I couldn't stand the Coppola movie, Sofia Coppola's movie, and I didn't at all like the recent French movie that came out either, so... I'm particularly enchanted with that earlier one. Yes?
Farewell, My Queen, you didn't like?
Farewell, My Queen, I think is the title of the new French movie. And the actress they chose is still completely unlike Marie Antoinette, all the depictions of... You get a very sort of straight-laced, thin-lipped woman. I mean, you could at least have tried to capture that kind of sensuous Habsburg mouth, you know, or something, but... It was just horrendously unwatchful of historical fact, I thought. Yeah. Yeah.
I thought the one thing that you mentioned also about that she had to be read to, that this last film, the point of the whole, that last film, Farewell, My Queen, is that she, her moments of comfort were always from the reader, she would sit there and read to her all the time. In Farewell, My Queen, there's that point you made about her.
Yes, they get that right, but that was about it. Yeah, and actually, I think she just didn't like to read that much because people did wear eyeglasses. There were eyeglasses in those days, so I don't think she was that much of a reader. She was very musical, and her sensibilities went much more in that direction. She was her teacher was Gluck, and she commissioned him a lot of works, and he had made him a very happy and wealthy man. And she had wonderful taste in music.
She played the harp,
and I think she played the spinet too. But I think so did most of the aristocratic women in that time. Yeah. I thought it was so superficial. I thought the portrait of Fersen and of the king was stupid and completely two-dimensional. I thought the whole concentration on the clothes was ridiculous. The concentration on the clothes is ridiculous. I mean, yes, she was known for liking her clothes, and Some people have said that it was one of the ways with which she tried to allay this melancholy strain in her nature. I mean, she was easily given to depressions. She was maybe kind of a bipolar, we would say today. And many people have explained her extreme. So the attention to clothes as being one of the ways in which she allayed her tendency to depression. Yeah.
How did you get interested in
I got into this because about 10 years ago, I reviewed a book, a biography of Marie Antoinette's, for the New Yorker, and I had never really noticed Fersen that much in the little that I read about Marie Antoinette. And she struck me as somebody that I would sometime like to write about, and that's how I came to write about him. At first, I didn't know the degree to which it would be his book. I set out to, when I began to write, it just came out in the first person, and one can't really dictate that. I mean, that comes out of, I think, the character dictates that to you. So it was bound to be in his voice, most of it. Yeah.
Do you have a systematic procedure or rules of thumb for deciding in unclear cases whether something actually happened or something actually was said?
Well, if you write historical fiction, you're inventing a lot of the conversations. You have to stick by the facts. Louis XVI has to be executed on January 23rd. Fersen has to die on April 28th, 1810. You have to stick to historical facts of that kind, but you're free to, and this is part of the fun of it as a genre, you're free to invent the decor of a room, the way their dogs prance through the room, their conversations and all those other things. There are facts, and these are the kind of, the trills which make the facts come more alive, like the trills in an aria. The Fatal Illusion,
which was and I don't know whether it was a novel, though I think it must have been, and it was the story of Marie Antoinette's love affair with Fersen.
I haven't come across it.
It's the
Who and who was the author? Oh, The Fatal Friendship, that's it, absolutely. It was written in the 30s, and I can't remember the name of the man. It was not Stefan Zweig, who was the first sort of major biographer, but I can't remember his name, but we'd find it in the card file downstairs. And that was a very good book. Yes?
There is a cemetery in Paris called
Picpus. A what in Paris?
What? It's the only cemetery in Paris where only those who were executed during the revolution are allowed to be laid.
Yes, in Picpus.
Yes.
Yes.
And is any of the royal family there? Or?
The royal family was... I've never quite understood how they did this, but the royal family, Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette, were... put into common graves. How the graves were identified, I don't know, but they are presently at this great cathedral in the suburbs of Paris called Saint-Denis. And they are both there, like most kings and queens of France, I mean, many, many of them. And I've never been able to find out how they identified the tombs, in the common graves in which they had been put in first, but I suppose they were witnesses who spoke up. But you can see the tombs at Saint Denis.
We have time for one more question.
That is my favorite question. You know, she had such this that that's as difficult as to define the word charisma, which he had to the nth degree. And charisma comes from the Greek, in which it means gift of grace. And it's a certain quality of presence which sets an individual apart from others and endows him with a kind of personal magnetism and charm. Like Greta Garbo had charisma, Joan Crawford did not. Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan had charisma, but not Woodrow Wilson or Jimmy Carter, right? And though she was not in any classical sense beautiful, she had this other trait, equally hard to define, which is style, which I suppose is a gift for choosing harmonious, original attire coupled with a stately bearing, for which she became legendary. But I think an even greater part of her fame and the fascination she exerted upon us lies on her fate, on her tragic fate. I think if she'd been spared the guillotine and sent into exile to Austria, she might entrench us far less. I think her martyrdom is at the heart of her attraction.
Well, on behalf of a very appreciative audience and on behalf of the head librarian, thank you for a wonderful presentation this evening. Thank you all for coming. I do want to put in one little plug for an event in 2 weeks' time on the 28th of November. We have an event with one of the winners of the New York City Book Awards from earlier this year. And it's going to be a wonderful event with Carla Peterson, Black Gotham, A Family History of African Americans in 19th Century New York City. So from the world of France and Europe back to New York City in 2 weeks' time. So do come out for that. We have books for sale outside, and the corner bookstore will be happy to sell you one, and autographs are available. Thanks for coming.